Thank you for joining us again for another informative episode of Satellite Nation. Satellite Nation is a weekly call-in show geared towards the hobby side of all things television. Brought to you by Satellite Guys Radio. Now here are your hosts, Michael and Brian.
Good evening, Satellite Nation. I'm Michael Graves, K4EST.
Good evening, I'm Brian Gold, Titanium Satellite. Welcome to Satellite Nation. Tonight, we're joined by Ken Reitz, KS4ZR. Now, Ken is the editor and publisher of the Spectrum Monitor. Now, that's an online magazine devoted to amateur radio, shortwave listening, AM, FM, television, Wi-Fi, scanning, satellites, vintage radio, and much, much more. For those of you who are going to stick around and participate tonight on the show, a little background, if you want to check out the website for Spectrum Monitor, you can go to www.thespectrummonitor.com. That's www.thespectrummonitor.com.
All right, everybody, let's get ready to call in to this live show for February 25th, 2015. Call in and talk about anything you want to talk about related to technology. Let us know. And I'm sure people's got some questions for Ken. So get ready and write this down. 877-SAT-GUYS. 1-877-728-4897. If you want to save us a little money, you can call 347-327-9319.
Now, if you miss the Satellite Nation show, you can find a link after the show on Satellite Guys Radio Forum at www.satelliteguys.us. Now, remember to like us on Facebook at facebook.com/Satellite Nation Radio. We'd like to hear from you, and if there's anything you want to talk about, let us know. Now, if you happen to be a Twitter person, you can check us out on Twitter at SatNatRadio. Now, we want to hear from you. Give us some feedback. Let us know what you like, what you want to hear more of, because this is your show.
And that is not my wife. She says, I don't see what you see in that Twitter. Also, we want to give a special thanks, as always, out to Scott Ruskowski at SatelliteGuys.us for putting us on Satellite Guys Radio and making this possible. And out to Dave Wallace from GotCBand.com and for the use of his IFCAS server.
And then also, we really appreciate that he puts together a great news segment every week. So thank you, Dave. Also want to put a thanks out to Ralph Black over at Access America. Now, he puts us up on Galaxy 19 KU band. So if you are listening to us on Satellite Guys or on the Internet, you can also listen to us over satellite. If you have a KU band satellite dish aimed at Galaxy 19, we're on, 12115 is the frequency. Now, right after our show is over, Ralph Black does have a talk show, a great talk show with Mike Cole, and that's called Sat Talk Radio. So right after our show at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, you can stay tuned to the same Satellite Guys or Access America and catch that show. And, of course, Michael, want to thank you for your support. Visit Michael's store at www.nc-electronics.com. That's www.nc, for North Carolina, -electronics.com.
And always your store, too, Brian, over at titaniumsatellite.com. That's like the metal titaniumsatellite.com. Now, these stores and people, these ones help to pay the bills and keeps this show running. So please go out and support them. And let's not forget, too, if you enjoy the show and want to support a little bit, you can go over to cafepress.com/Satellite Nation Radio. And actually, it might be just Satellite Nation, but one of those will work. And buy a T-shirt or a coffee mug or whatever at Satellite Nation. And I've got a couple of those shirts, and they're really high-quality shirts. They really are. So go over there and get you one of those.
All right. Now, next up, we're going to have a new segment, News by Dave. Now, in this segment, he has some great information about a DirecTV outage that they just went through and some changes that are going to happen over at Dish Network. So let's take a listen now.
Mm-hmm. This is Dave with the news for February 25th, 2015. So if you're a DirecTV subscriber, last Thursday, So apparently last Thursday, DirecTV had a major technical issue affecting their D10 satellite, which went haywire and basically lost 40 high-definition channels. DirecTV scrambled, and props to them. Apparently, from reports, because DirecTV is being very tight-lipped, which they normally always are, actually restored 40 channels to the new D14 in less than 12 hours. Now, that's just a rumor. They were on D14 for a while. Apparently, they have been returned back to D10 because I guess they were able to regain control of that bird again. But people had lost 40 HD channels. A few things that are concerning to me, especially if you're a DirecTV subscriber, that D10 satellite is a Boeing BSS-702. It went up in July 7th of 2007, and it's at 103 west. You know, they had launched, you know, D14, and that apparently was going to be for the 4K. So what is concerning is if this DirecTV number 10 goes bad and they have to use number 14 for that HD, this could devastate their 4K plans. Very concerning, especially I want to see something 4K. I don't care who brings it out. Dish, Direct, doesn't matter. I just want to see it. I think other people are in the same boat. So we'll just have to wait and see. We'll probably never hear anything about this whatsoever, because DirecTV is quite quiet about all this kind of stuff. But we'll see. Now, DirecTV 15 is scheduled to launch, you know, first half of this year, and that's going to be a different satellite. It won't be a Boeing, so they may be done with the Boeing birds. We'll just have to wait and see. Anyways, thankfully they got the high-definition channels restored, and props out to the DirecTV engineering team for probably busting their butts to make it happen for everybody. So yesterday, Dish Network released their earnings, but also before they released their earnings, they came out with a big announcement. Joe Clayton is going to retire March 31st, 2015. He's the CEO of Dish Network for about 4 years. I met him a few times at CES. He seemed to be just a great guy. On the conference call, Charlie indicated that he had taught them quite a few things, and most notably saying, treat your customer good and give them a good product. So the new CEO is the old CEO, Mr. Ergen. So we'll just have to wait and see what's going to happen there at Dish Network. I did listen to the call, and Roger Lynch, which has never been on the call before, which is the CEO or director of the Sling TV, was on there. They didn't really release any numbers, so to say, of how many subscribers they have, except saying that growth is what they thought it was going to be in their target demographic. They did mention that they were a little concerned with the Comcast-Time Warner merger, because that would make them the internet providers in 19 of the 20 top markets, where that is their prime market for Sling TV. Charlie also talked quite a bit about the spectrum play, and fielded questions from analysts and reporters. You know, didn't really have anything new besides, you know, they might run into some problems trying to get devices certified, and the big guys are going to try to fight them in that But other than that, just a normal quarter, and Joe retired, so we'll have to see how Mr. Ergen takes over the helm of the company he started. Hey, so we got a new product alert. I'm going to throw it out to my buddy, Mr. Michael, over at NCElectronics.com. He has got some Stab HH90 motors shipped to you for just $78. Hey, this is Dave with the news. I'll check you out next week.
Thank you, Dave.
So tell us about those Stab motors. I know those are a pretty popular item for KU band dishes.
Yeah, they're always, from my experience, been the best KU motor you can get your hands on.
Agreed.
We just so happened to get a good deal on some and get some in. They just came in Monday or yesterday. Yesterday they landed, so. We have some Stab motors. You can go to my website, and you also go to Dave's. He's got some, too, at NCElectronics.com, NC-Electronics.com, or gotcband.com, and $78 shipped.
Now, that's for the HH90, so that's suitable for the 90-centimeter dishes, correct, with the, I think it's a 42-millimeter clamp?
Yes.
Okay.
42-millimeter. Mm-hmm.
So that will fit like the GeoSat Pro 90s. That will fit a lot of the dishes out there. So if you have a dish out there that uses the standard, it's about a 1 5/8 inch mast. That will fit right on these. And I agree. Stab HH90s are by far the best motors out there. I've had one that's been humming along here for, oh boy, 10 plus years.
Yeah, I've got, what's the last one? I've got a motor graveyard out there. I put the motor next to the ditch.
Well, a lot of interesting things in there about the news. The one thing I still am interested in trying through Dish Network is Sling TV. I know they're adding more and more channels. You can get Sling TV with a lot of those great channels on Roku boxes and a lot of other platforms. Have you tried Sling yet?
Yeah, I tried it. And it's working pretty good, you know. On the I've got the satellite internet, but it's the top package, and it works. Of course, I got to watch, you know, my bandwidth, but it works. It works pretty smooth, and it's, you know, Joe had mentioned on his website it's got a strange look to it, and he can't explain it. And I was watching the same thing. I was like, "What is that strange? It's hard to explain." And I read where he said it. I said, "Well, at least I know I'm not crazy." But yeah, it works pretty good.
Now, is this something like Roku and other services? When you first tune to the channel, it kind of has a weird buffering occur, or is this all the time that you see this artifacting?
Just when it starts up, it does that, and they all do that kind of. But then it looks like it's kind of washed out look, but it's hard to explain. But it kind of stays that way throughout the, you know, whole time I've watched it.
Interesting.
And it's all whatever channel I tune to.
Now, are you watching this on the Amico A3, or is that on some other device?
Yeah. No, it's on the A3.
Okay.
So it might be A3 related, or, and I ain't watched it in about a week, so they may have corrected something, or it may just be an A3 thing. I don't know.
Well, just big news for the A3 today. Announcement just came out. EPG is available for 95 West, 97 West, and 99 West for select channels on the C and KU on 95 and 97, and on KU for 99. So this is a really big first for North America.
This is. This has been something I've been, of course, me and you knew a little bit about it before it went public, and I was, oh, I can't wait for everybody to hear about this, you know. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely. So if you haven't tried it yet, it is shipping on all of the new Amico A3 receivers that start shipping tomorrow. But it's going to be rolled out for all current A3 owners here in the next in the short period of time. So it's available on the testing ROM right now, isn't it, when you do the Eurotrash update?
Yeah, yep. It's on there if you do that.
Okay, so I know there's going to be a lot more information. Really big news, though, about the Amico A3 starting this Friday. What's going to be happening, Joe? That Joe offered us. I'm sorry.
We got offering rebates. I don't know which retailers or resellers are going to be doing it, but we have a rebate if you buy one.
Yeah, and this is no small rebate. So it's going to be a mail-in rebate for all participating Amoco North America resellers. And check out the different reseller websites on Friday, because I know there's going to be an announcement made for a most excellent rebate, which will mean dollars in your pocket, or I think some of them will give you credit at their store. Really going to be a great deal. And so not only are you going to get an Android, a very powerful with a lot of cool features, but you're also going to get a little money back from Amoco.
With the EPG on the select channels, you know, it's going to be on select, on everything. But.
Yep, and I've been playing with that EPG. It is pretty cool to be able to set your timers and everything just from that EPG screen. So really liking that.
Oh, yeah. Well, Friday, everybody will have all the details Friday on their respective website.
Yep. All right. Now, tonight, joining us, very patiently waiting for us to finish up all our yik-yak and chit-chat here, we have Ken Reitz joining us from the Spectrum Monitor, KS4ZR. Good evening, Ken.
Hello, Brian, and hello, Michael. How are you guys doing today?
We are doing great. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us. Tell us a little bit about the Spectrum Monitor. Now, the Spectrum Monitor is a magazine, and tell us about the magazine and your role in that magazine.
Okay, well, I'm the publisher and general managing editor for the Spectrum Monitor, and it's a electronic publication that comes out every month. This is our second year, and it's available only as a PDF format, so it's a download. Each month, subscribers get an email with download, and you go to the website and download the issue, and that's all there is to it.
But it's a great magazine. Yeah, I've been reading the magazine for a year now, and it's not just about one subject. You cover a lot of information.
Well, we do, and in the interest of full disclosure, I have to say that Brian and Titanium Satellite are advertisers for in the Spectrum Monitor, and we really appreciate that. It's the intent of the magazine is to cover as much of the spectrum as we can each month, and we do a pretty good job of it. We're a follow-on magazine to the old Monitoring Times, and a lot of people will be familiar with them. They had been around for 33 years before closing the doors in December 2013.
Now, I know you were a contributor to that magazine for many years, so what brought you around to say, hey, you know, we need another magazine? How did the Spectrum Monitor come about after the other magazine closed?
Well, it was pretty simple. Bob Grove, the publisher of Monitoring Times at the time, MT, we referred to it as, had called up and said that he was going to stop the magazine, cease publication with the December issue. Now, this was back at the end of July 2013. So I looked around, and at the time I was the managing editor for MT, and I thought to myself, golly, it'd be nice to keep working. it also happened that jobs were pretty scarce and still are, especially in the publishing business. That's just about anybody who's a writer can attest. So I decided to continue the legacy of Monitoring Times with the Spectrum Monitor, and you can just refer to it as TSM if you like. It's a lot easier, so that's what we did. The writers. The MT writers at the time, and they, of course, were out of work as well. So we decided to just band together and do the best we could at continuing the product that Bob Grove started back in 1982.
Now, I think you're really selling yourself short. I don't think you're just trying to keep up to what it was. I must say the Spectrum Monitor is definitely information packed, and it's a great mix of some antique stuff, some current technology, some reviews, and you know, the magazine was out for several months before I contacted you to become a a sponsor, and I must say it was the quality of the magazine and the information, because, you know, I go way back. I don't know about you, Michael. When did you first start reading the Monitoring Times?
The Monitoring Times? I started reading Monitoring Times in 1992. And then I learned about, of course, Spectrum Monitor last year and just recently subscribed to it. Monitoring Times, and of course, a couple of people that run Monitoring Times, I've known them a little longer than that. So.
And the contributors, definitely, you know, we've chatted with Mario. He gives you a lot of the software-defined radio articles, and definitely the contributing writers that you have for that really make it a great magazine. So any of you out there who are interested in technology, definitely would suggest that you head over to the spectrummonitor.com. $24 a year gives you a full subscription and a lot of great articles. So tell us a little bit about what your passion is, Ken. What I know you're an amateur radio operator, so maybe tell us a little bit about how you got involved in amateur radio and how that led to being part of the Monitoring Times.
Actually, it didn't. The satellite TV is how I started with MT. It was in 1984. I first put in my first dish with a C-band dish. Of course, in those days, it was C-band only, and a big old 10-foot fiberglass dish was weighed about 500 pounds. It was colossus of the backyard. And so I played around with it for a couple of years, and I had been a subscriber to MT since 83 when it started. So I called Bob on the phone one time, and I said, Bob, yeah, you're really missing something here in MT. You don't have any coverage for satellite, and this is where it's happening. And he didn't know much about it at the time either, and so I talked his ear off for about an hour and finally said, okay, look, why don't you just write an article and send it in? If we like it, we'll publish. If we don't, you won't have to hear from us again, and we won't have to hear from you again. So, nothing. So I just sat down and wrote up a little article. This is in 87, and so he handed it over to the editor. At that time was Larry Miller. And so, and everything, you have to remember, this is, everything was done by snail mail at that time.
Right.
And so I got a letter from the editor, and he said, that, oh, yeah, well, we'll see if we can't put this in sometime. And the months dragged by and dragged by, and I never did hear anything. Finally, I heard from him in May, I think it was, 88, and he said, oh, by the way, we're going to put that article you did last fall on the satellites, going to put it in MT. I said, oh, that's great. And he said, yeah, and we decided to make it a monthly column. And guess what? You're late for your next issue.
So when you
started.
Okay, when you started out in C-band, what was available out there? Was it what was your first equipment, and do you remember your first channel that you tuned in?
Oh, sure. In those days, you had an LNA. It didn't have any LNBs. And it was all done with, it was 120 degree LNA, which is,
oh, wow.
Is pretty laughable today. And it was done with a very large cable with end connectors, that you ran the data from the, LNA into a down converter, which was mounted out of the box.
Oh yeah. Remember those well.
Yep. And so then you took that and back and ran that into your receiver. And this was in fact, I still remember it was an Amplica. I don't know if you remember that brand. Or
not. Oh, yeah. That was that was a top of the line.
Yeah, it really was. And it was great. It was one of the first that included, I think they had the dish drive power supply actually in the receiver. So they were trying to consolidate all the boxes. In those days, you had dozens of boxes sitting around.
Right.
All connected up with different wires. It's an integrated. It's pretty doggone nice. So there weren't that many satellites at the time, and so that was kind of a problem. So I wrote this monthly article, monthly column for MT, and that went on for a couple of years, and then it was actually 2 years, and then Bob started Satellite Times, which was a sister publication to MT.
Right.
Bob Grove, published with both magazines, made Larry Van Horn the editor-in-chief of Satellite Times, who was also an early writer for MT and the Milcom specialist, and still involved today in writing about that.
Now, what was the first channel? Do you remember that first channel you tuned in?
Probably it was NASA.
All right.
Because it was pretty amazing. The space shuttle was a big deal in those days.
Right.
And so you would search around for and you'd just watch that for hours. The guys running around the gantry, and they show the whole thing. It was absolutely fascinating. Good to watch. And so it was a combination of backhauls from news gathering organizations and regular things that people never got a chance to see, like the NASA channel and stuff.
Right. And then I just remember some of the strange next door neighbors, like TBN right next to Playboy and
there were a lot of, in those days nothing was scrambled. Very little. It may have been one or two, and they were really primitive scrambling techniques, the inverted video or something like that.
I almost went cross-eyed when they first started scrambling some of those channels.
Right. Yeah. It was pretty amazing. That started in '80s. I'm sorry, Michael was saying something.
Oh, I just said. And then they started scrambling everything, and then you got a stack of the scramblers stacked up over beside your receiver.
Oh, yeah.
So you first got involved with MT by writing the satellite column, and then it turned into a monthly column. What were some of the highlights back in those days as you started letting people know about what was up there and how they could watch it?
Well, probably one of the more interesting things were the audio subcarriers. There were quite a few radio stations that were sending the signals up as audio subcarriers. Of course, remember, this is all analog, so you would have a particular channel up, and then you'd have several subcarriers from that that would retransmit various radio stations. It was truly amazing to be able to listen to static-free stations from all over the country.
Right.
On
that Amplica, I believe you could had the manual audio tuning, so you could tune up and down, and then plus also it had the IF out, so you could hook that up to a scanner.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, you could take the composite. I think it was a composite output or something, and then you could use that to break it into to further like single channel for carrier frequencies and stuff
right.
like that. And the thing to remember is that this is a technology that continues to evolve. And what I tell people today is that satellite TV, free-to-air satellite as we know it right now, is actually considerably better than anything that we had in the beginning. The amount of programming, the amount of the variation of channels, audio and video channels is truly amazing. And not only that, it's better. When everything was analog, you were really susceptible to all kinds of problems. If you lived near a terrestrial telephone installation, microwave installation, you certain channels just completely disappeared. It was pretty tough.
Right, and those filters were not cheap at all.
They weren't cheap, and they didn't work very well either. I know that much.
Yeah, I agree with you. Now, the heyday, everybody talks about the heyday. I think it was because of the type of programs that were up there. But really, like you said, it was very limited. You were limited to either 24 transponders, and very few satellites ran all 24 transponders on KU or C-band. Then KU came along, and they were split transponders. There could be, I believe, up to 36 transponders. But there was very little up on the KU.
Yeah, and it was also hard to get a hold of decent KU receiving equipment as well, the LNBs. So it was nothing easy about it. Plus, it turns out that many of these 10-foot dishes were terrific for C-band, but they really weren't all that efficient
yeah,
as
I
far as the signal.
and for tracking, because I just remember a lot of those were just set up. They didn't even have declination out off the settings. And so when you were trying to track the arc, you only were having to track four or five satellites. So they really didn't even consider putting a horizon to horizon tracking. And then suddenly people were trying to put KU LMBs on it and couldn't figure out why they were getting such bad reception. Those good old days weren't necessarily so good, were they?
No, not at all. And in fact, everything was so expensive. When you look at the kind of stuff that's available, the electronics, the efficiency of the electronics, and the cost is just nothing compared to what it is to, what it was in the beginning.
So here here we are 30 some years later. And what are you running now? What do you have dish wise and receivers for the hobby now?
Well, I have one of the old 10-foot black mesh dishes in the back. It's a CKD band. Wore out. I've gone through several actuators because it does get quite a workout. For about 10 years, I was the kept the transponder watch for Satellite Entertainment Guide, which used to be a monthly publication. It was a monthly satellite TV guide for North America, and I was in charge of their keeping up with the transponder's audio and the various other services, and wrote several columns, feature articles, and that sort of thing. So you can imagine what kind of a workout that first actuator mode I had.
Definitely wasn't going to rust into a set position.
No, that was... And then the next one I got was a 36-inch actuator because I was interested in the Atlantic Ocean region satellites, the AOR satellites, and that was really... That was a real eye-opener, and it is today, too. It's the place where the most interesting stuff is happening. I've got several KU band dishes that are tied together with a dissect switch, and it all sort of works seamlessly, and it's got a couple of receivers because you really have, you've got to keep several different things going, and if you have different parts of the house, you have to cover those, too. So.
Yep.
It's kind of wild. I've got antennas all over the place.
Well, Michael, are you there?
I'm there. I'm just, I was going to ask Ken, we could talk about this for hours, but let's get back into your magazine. Cover some of the topics that you cover and why you cover them. Starting off with, go ahead.
The current issue is the February issue. And it's kind of interesting. The cover story is monitoring the Russian Navy, which is kind of a timely sort of thing. We're about to release the March issue, which is coming out probably Friday, and that's our aviation special. This continues the tradition we started at Monitoring Times about 13 years ago, and it was always a popular feature each year. So it's basically an air show special. There's a lot of there's articles in there about taking your scanners and listening to air shows when you go, because it's one thing to see it, but it's another thing to be able to listen to the action on your scanner as you're at the air show.
Right.
And there's a lot of other articles, and that's coming out in Friday. We've covered just about everything. I mean, if you look at the list in 2014, there were over 1,000 pages in TSM for the last year, and we covered everything from monitoring NATO war games to Mars amateur radio. We have November's our buyer's guide. We also December's always the vintage radio special. A lot of interesting articles in there if you're into vintage radio. So we try to hit the high spots on just about everything each month. And there's a lot of material out there to work with, so there's no end to the material, I can assure you.
Oh, that's for sure. You'll never run out of something to talk about or write about or whatever. So you always have something
right
in there, that's sure.
Well, as technology changes, we look at kind of the digital as the, you know, that's where all the information is. But, you know, there's a lot of stuff still out there. We're on Satellite Guys. I know there's a lot of guys talking about AM radio DXing. Kind of stepping back a little bit, what are the main challenges that you see for like AM radio and shortwave at this point?
Well, there's a lot of problems right now, particularly for AM. First of all, it doesn't get any respect. Just from just about every corner, it gets beaten down. The FCC has not been kind to it since the FM days, going back to the 1950s. But the big problem right now has to do with interference stuff. The fact that if you live in any kind of an urban or a suburban location, your AM tuning is really tough to do. Things that the digital equipment and digital artifacts that are in the air, thanks to modern appliances, things like compact fluorescent lights and LEDs, and a lot of times with the circuitry in your washing machine and your TV, and they're spraying the RF all over the band. It's most most particular in the AM band, so you have that problem. You also have a problem of crowding. There's the band is relatively small, and the FCC just sort of let it go. It doesn't seem to have had much thought into it. Second, third problem that we're having now is with IBOC, the in-channel on-band or in-band on-channel digital service that Ubiquiti has been pushing for the last 15 years. It hasn't gotten much traction, especially in AM. But the problem is that of the method of transmitting it, it puts out a lot of hash on the sides of the actual transmission, so it kind of obliterates what's happening on either side of a particular radio station.
Right. And in fact, today Mario had posted up something on the amateur radio forum over at Satellite Guys showing a snapshot off of HDR, the waterfall, showing the digital carriers on the sides of, what was that, 710 out of New York, I believe it is?
Yeah.
And so...
Right, yeah, that's a... Yeah. Boy, yeah, and New York has got, they're all doing it there, so big deal.
You know, and it kind of begs the question of, well, you know, AM radio, that was big in the 60s. Why is it important to us now? I mean, we have cell phones, we have FM radio. Why is AM radio still important for communication?
Well, it's becoming more and less relevant, and one of the reasons is that, the presence of streaming, it's a lot more convenient now for people to actually just stream their local AM radio station. They don't have to worry about the hash they're getting, static crashes during the summertime. They don't have to worry about fading. The signal's always there. And not only that, the AM station is no longer confined to its transmitting circle, whatever footprint it can gain out of the stick that it puts behind the station. It's accessible now worldwide, so that kind of changes it too. So actually transmitting in the AM band is kind of less and less relevant. And the other thing is I don't think that it's particularly profitable. I know that there's, out of the top 100 stations, there's probably most of them are turning a profit, but when you get out of that a stratosphere of AM broadcasting,
yeah, we're starting to lose you a little bit on your Skype connection there, but I know you're still there, Ken. So, you know, AM radio, it's quite interesting. Do you think this is something that will disappear in our lifetime, or do you think it's going to stay but just morph into something else?
Yeah, I think it's probably already disappeared for most people. It's still a big deal for sports enthusiasts because they can still listen to the, and almost all the major sports franchises are still, their flagship station is still an AM station,
right, so right.
It's still maintains relevance as far as broadcasting to a local group goes. But Young people are listening less and less to any kind of radio. It doesn't matter what it is, AM or FM. They're streaming on mobile devices, and so they're not all that concerned with whether or not it's which band is it on, AM or FM. And
it's no longer.
As I say,
Yeah, it's no longer video killed the radio star. I think iTunes and Tuned In killed the radio star.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, there's a number of things, and I bring up the idea of satellite radio, which is pretty extraordinary when you think about what they're doing. The problem with streaming is it requires a two-way street in order to get the signal to and from the station. You've got to make a two-way connection. But you don't need that with satellite radio, and there's no limit to the number of people who can be listening, and there's tens of millions of listeners to satellite radio. And the advantage, of course, is that they can, because it's a subscription model, they can pretty much cherry-pick the best stations and the best announcers and the best music. It comes down, it's not interfered with. The technology is truly amazing. If you look at the size of the little antenna that you've got and realize you're getting 100-some-odd channels and quality audio coming down, it's really extraordinary. It's not affected by weather. I've got XM in-house here and also, of course, in the radio, but in-house it's really great. A little 2-inch by 2-inch antenna just sits in the windowsill. It doesn't matter if it's snowing or raining or thundering or what. It just keeps working.
But I find it very interesting, just like the cord cutters and the cord nevers, though, we have a new generation that aren't even really looking seriously at live streaming off of satellite. And so I've read a couple articles where they're even concerned about the future of the investment in services such as XM, just because everybody is carrying around their personal tunes, and it seems that internet is, you know, available, or cellular delivery is available for most listeners.
Yeah, I wouldn't sell satellite radio. And a number of people have done so for the last 10 years, and I'm always amazed because the model is pretty good. For one thing, they cornered the market. Of course, it's a monopoly. You have to remember it's a monopoly. There's only one company that can do satellite radio, so that's a pretty sweet setup to begin with. You don't have any competitors.
Yeah.
So the price is never going to come down from what it is. It's an extremely profitable business, unlike DirecTV or Dish Network, which are, even though they're turning a profit, they're losing subscribers pretty much each quarter. But that isn't the case for satellite radio.
And satellite radio also, their cost is just licensing for music. You know, really above that, they don't have the overhead like Dish and DirecTV have for purchasing their programming.
Well, no, but they have a tremendous amount of overhead as well. You have to remember that they these satellites themselves are extremely
right.
A lot of money to keep them flying, as would any other satellite. So they do have that
those
same
true.
Expenses. And you'll notice that Howard Stern does not work cheap.
Yeah.
No.
Hey, if you're listening in this evening and you have a question or a comment, want to talk to Ken Reitz, you can give us a call now.
Phone lines are now open for Satellite Nation. Call us at 877-SAT-GUYS or 877-728-4897.
So if you want to give a call in, 347-327-9319. All right, so boy, we've hit satellite and we've hit some other things, but let's hear about amateur radio. When did you first get your license, Ken, and how are you involved now?
Well, I got my first ticket. It was a novice ticket in '88. This was the same, basically the same month that I started, because it suddenly occurred to me that, and I'd been a shortwave listener since 1965. I started out with a Nightkit Star Roamer, which I built along with a friend of mine who was in high school. We were in high school together. We were juniors. And he had the advantage because he was the one who owned the soldering iron. And he also had been taking an electronics course by correspondence. So he knew how to solder. So I was like, wow, that's pretty good. So every day for about 6 weeks, we spent sorting out the thousands of parts that came in this enormous box. Eventually, we did put it together, and eventually it did not work. And so I did have to take it down to the radio. The local radio guy looked at it, and he says, well, the problem is that you have a couple of capacitors that were DOA from the manufacturer. So that made this feel a little bit better, even though I'm not sure that was true.
I'm just telling you that. Wow, so you got that going, and then...
But as a shortwave listener in 65, and then eventually I've always been a shortwave listener, but I found myself in 88 working at MT and realizing that I needed to cover as much of the spectrum as I could. So my daughter, who was 12 years old at the time, we got together and got our tickets that summer. Because I needed somebody to send code to, and so I said, "Hey, you want to learn Morse code?" And she said, "What's that?" So the next thing you knew, a couple of months later, we were sitting for our novice exam, and then we just took it from there.
Well, we have a caller from area code 504. Area code 504. Go ahead. Who do we have there?
Hi, this is Ralph in New Orleans.
Good evening, Ralph. How are you this evening?
I've been listening to your show, very informative. I like the, I like your guest. I want to throw something in what you all just talked. Since I was part owner of an AM station once, and I think the only future AM radio has is it goes all digital.
Yes.
If it's iBark or whatever system they choose, I think we're going to be stuck with iBark. It's not the most favorable system, but that's the only way for AM radio to survive. Then people will go back to it because of the clarity of the signal, and the bandwidth. It doesn't sound like it's coming through a tunnel. I think that's why a lot of people stayed away from AM. It was the first kind of radio we had. That's why people listened to it. But when FM came along, they created themselves a great competition.
Gentlemen, I have a question for you. You know, we chose a format that the rest of the world didn't choose. You know, the rest of the world is DAB. Do you think this is going to have an impact on the embracing of digital?
You mean the music format? You mean the music format I have on Access America?
No, the DAB, the digital audio broadcast, instead of being... the proprietary that we chose in North America?
It was not my choice to use iBot for digital radio.
Now, Ken...
I had to live with what they gave us.
Right, right. Now, Ken, do you think this is one of the factors for digital AM or digital FM not catching on?
I think what is the company called? Ubiquiti. I think they failed very much to make the system popular, to make deals with car. Most people listen to radio in the car.
Yes.
And they failed to make deals with car manufacturers to put these kinds of radios in there who want to get digital radio. That's why I think that whole digital thing failed a little bit. Was a wrong kind of marketing.
I tend to agree. Ken, what's your input, Ken?
Yeah, that's good points. Good points all. And one of the problems is that we're pretty much stuck with IBOC. Now, this is the FCC's decision. Despite what other engineers or other countries are doing, it doesn't matter. We're stuck with it. They've invested in broadcast industries, invested billions of dollars. And
a lot of radio engineers out in the land that don't like it.
Oh, yes. It's very unpopular among radio engineers. That is absolutely true. But we're stuck with it. Regulatorily, we're stuck with it. So, what can you do?
So AM will only survive if it goes all digital and turns analog off, so they don't interfere with each other.
So do you think there is a chance for us to go that direction, or do you think the legacy analog will continue to hold on to the AM spectrum?
Oh, sure. It'll continue in this kind of a hybrid system. for the foreseeable future. And one of the reasons is that the FCC really doesn't care all that much about, I mean, there's one particular commissioner, Ajit Pai, who is really interested in reforming AM, but he's really not getting a lot of traction among his fellow commissioners, I don't think. It doesn't really seem to me like it's getting anywhere, but anyway, people are becoming more aware of it.
And we had AM stations then transmitted in IBOC and in analog. IBOC stands actually for in-band on-channel.
Right.
That's what the IBOC stands for. But there was a lot of interference with it. But I think if they turn all the IBOC, it could work.
Right.
Well, you know, it's been one of those things for me.
That's the only future I see by AM radio.
Yeah, it's, you know, I think if HD had been placed on every AM radio that you bought for the last 15 years, you know, people would be aware of it. And, you know, right. How many formats of digital were there or are there?
You mean digital? They can do the same thing as in TV right now. They send the analog signal. And can have like 2-3 subcarriers on IBOC.
Right. Yeah, as I recall, weren't there something like 15 different digital formats that were just adopted by different AM stations?
Mm-hmm.
Right
now it's easier for AM stations to pick something off from Premier Radio off the satellite and makes no work. It's all distributed.
Right. Right.
It makes no work. They get that little hole to put a local commercial in there. And it's easy work. Nobody wants to do anything. When you drive around in the afternoon, you listen to AM on every second station just about to hear Rush Limbaugh.
Yep. All right. Well, we thank you, Ralph, for calling in. Ralph's show is up next after ours on Access America and Satellite Guys, Sat Talk Radio with Michael Cole. So stay tuned and listen to that show right after ours.
Okay. Let me get ready for the show. Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, thank you for calling, Ralph.
Take
bye
care. Bye-bye.
So, Ken, do you think the failure of AM radio could really just be because of that whole licensing issue of not including digital on every radio sold in the last 15 years?
Well, no, I really there's simply too much competition. It's kind of like the last horse running in the Kentucky Derby. It's you know, it's there, but. Still have to feed it at the end of the race.
Good one.
The best you can say.
Good point. Now, shortwave radio, really big, you know, when I was growing up, and I used to listen there, and that's probably the main reason I'm into technology is because of shortwave radio. What's going on with shortwave radio now?
Well, it's the same. I feel the same way. As I said before, I pretty much came up in the technology from shortwave right now, the biggest problems are there's basically several. One is the disappearing sunspots. As the propagation disappears, makes it even harder to do an already challenging thing, which is listen to a broadcast in shortwave. In addition to that, the stations are disappearing. There's a never-ending global recession. Countries have found that they don't really have the money to keep these massive broadcast entities together anymore. So they're targeting the areas that they want to hit with shortwave, and the rest they're giving to online streaming and to local broadcasting through FM affiliates and satellite broadcasting and stuff. So, you know, they're really counting their pennies is what it boils down to, and they're doing the best they can with it.
Yep.
There's also, we talked about digital for AM, there's Digital Radio Mondial, which is the digital for shortwave, and it's got a lot of promise. And I've never seen a group work harder than the people who have been promoting this for the last 20 years. But they also don't seem to have gotten a lot of traction. They're up against the same thing, diminishing sunspots, diminishing funding from And it's expensive stuff to add DRM to your analog
shortwave
broadcast station. So these are problems that are kind of almost insurmountable for shortwave. But as far as the shortwave hobby goes, the big stuff is happening in between the shortwave bands, the international broadcast bands, and that's all the utility monitoring and the various different things that are happening. That's all opened up thanks to the advent of software-defined radios, which are now making it possible to do things that you couldn't even dream of doing even 5 years ago with the radio.
Yeah, we've had a couple of shows about software-defined radio, and it's amazing. Even just if you just get into it with a $15 dongle, if nothing else, you are just opening up the world of RF. Now, we're going to have to wrap up here. We only have about 1 minute left, but, you know, I just want to invite everyone over to check out the Spectrum Monitor at thespectrummonitor.com. And our guest this evening has been Ken Reitz, KS4ZR, and we would love to have you on again sometime if you'd be willing to be our guest again.
No problem, Brian. I'm always available.
Well, we certainly ran out of time, but we have a ton of more things to talk about, so we would love to have you on again sometime. And I know there's a list of many other things that are covered in the Spectrum Monitor that really are very interesting to talk about, and I would love to have you on again sometime.
Well, I appreciate it, and I really appreciate the invitation. Thank you so much.
Definitely. So this evening we've had Ken Reitz, KS4ZR, the Spectrum Monitor. So if you're into amateur radio, shortwave, television, Wi-Fi radio, satellites, whatever it is, it's a great magazine to check out, and that's thespectrummonitor.com.
Yes, sir. Real good magazine. I really enjoy reading it every month. I like a magazine like that that's got a lot of content to it, and if you feel like you're reading something.
Well, you know what that music means there, Michael.
Yep, it's time to say goodnight for this week.
All right. Well, until next time, you have a great week, Satellite Nation.
Good night, everybody.
Tuned in tonight. Join Satellite Guys Michael and Brian next Wednesday for another informative episode of Satellite Nation. And don't forget to like our page at facebook.com/Satellite Nation Radio. Until next week, good night.